Well, welcome everybody, and Ron, so pleased that you could be with us. I noticed that we've sort of advertised you as talking about the relationship between neighborhoods and local governments, and we'll look forward to that, but I'd be interesting first to know how you got to where you are in terms of the work you're presently doing in this sphere. So tell us a little about your history.
Thanks. It's really great to be here. I was really fortunate in that at a fairly young age, I fell into the field of community development, and in particular, the community engagement and organizing side of it. Came to Chicago right out of college, having done a bunch of issue-based organizing, in part to see what Harold Washington was doing with local government. It seemed like a new progressive way to do urban government. And then within 6 months, two things happened. One, Harold Washington passed away, and the local city government got taken back over by less progressive elements. And I was introduced to Jody Kretzmann. And both those things really set my path. Did a lot of organizing in Chicago, trained out of the sort of traditional Alinsky model, but with Jody in my ear the whole time, realizing that there was a whole bunch of untapped local power in that model. Came out back to the West Coast because I'm from the West Coast and I missed it. Did rural work for a number of years. Did some local multifamily affordable housing development for a few years where we stabilize people's homes and then by giving them a safe and affordable place to live, but then engage them in, you know, identifying their gifts and talents and what they could do to make their community, surrounding community, stronger now that they were stable. And then for the last 12 years, been just mostly engaged in a number of endeavors around ABCD training and practice, asset-based community development, and some organizational stuff. And then I do a fair amount of what's broadly categorized as evaluation work, but basically helping folks in communities and their organizational partners define their own stories and measure their own impact and be able to lead that that engagement rather than being told by foundations or funders what they should be counting or measuring. So I really enjoy that work as well.
Now that's fascinating. Can you say a bit more about how you go about that and what's the alternative to somebody from the outside doing the evaluation? How does it work? How does it look?
Well, part of it is like most of this work is about language and making sure folks on the ground in their communities are familiar with the language that institutions use around impacts and outcomes and activities. That's pretty easy. Folks get that. And then it's a lot of just giving people permission, creating space to say, well, what do you want the impact of this work to be for you and your community? And defining that and then backing up into what things do you want to do to make that happen? How will you know if you're on your way? What kinds of things could happen that would cause you to want to change course? And then we just rate that down and go meet with their funders and say, this is how we're thinking about telling this story. Does that work for you? Sometimes funders have some additional things that they need to do, but most of the time they're excited that folks want to define their own story. Some groups want to, you know, like to do surveys of their neighbors. Some like to do focus groups. Some like to do interviews at community events and block parties. A lot of groups like to, especially youth, like to do observation techniques where they observe how maybe a park or is being used or an intersection is functioning or not functioning and then make their case around making changes to that. So it can be a pretty empowering process for folks.
And in that sense, I remember in the days of my organizing, no one wanted really to be evaluated. Evaluation was a dirty word. right?
Right.
But what you've done is redefined it so that the local actors are setting their own agendas and goals, and then assessing against their own standards how they're doing, and then changing where it seems to be appropriate.
Right. It done that way, it brings a lot of intentionality to people's work in their community, and creates some space for learning and self-reflection. So, it for me, it was sort of a circle back around to in early days in college, being exposed to liberation theology and the whole action reflection model. And then I got into organizing, where everybody was mostly about the action and not a lot of reflection was happening. And it felt like that kept the power in the hands of the professionals and out of the leaders. And by putting the reflection back in, I think it helps keep the community members in charge of what's happening and where they want to go and what they're learning. But yeah, it's a shift from monitoring to learning.
So one of the things that I know you have done is to work with neighborhoods around how they could become more powerful, and then how do they relate to institutions. And I think here you have some special expertise about linking to governments when you need to. So can you give us the sort of sequence, how you go about the local strengthening, and then how you move to the connection government or other institutions?
So in general, I mostly get engaged in situations where a community wants to be stronger, and often vis-a-vis its relationship with local government is feeling ignored, or the actions are being taken that are not what they want, or the people aren't listening. So, and a lot of time that's because the process has been through sort of some traditional means of you know, advisory groups and attending council meetings. And sometimes it's just hard for a local neighborhood to compete with all the other power in those situations, or for local politicos to see that there's value in giving their time and attention to that neighborhood for their goals. So a lot of times it starts, use the ABCD process and just start saying, okay, well, what do we have to work with by doing the asset mapping, asset identification, and then what could we do with that without the attention of any of the powerful people, either government or nearby corporations that we're trying to get the attention of. Let's just put them on hold for a while. And then folks get busy getting some things done that they can do, which is a relatively transformational process. Often the transformation happens as soon as we start doing the asset identification. The common response is, I had no idea we had this much. People who've lived in neighborhoods 50, 60 years will say, we had no idea we had this much. And so with that, which is very invigorating, people engage. We just start talking about what could you do with all this together? What do you want to do? What do you want to, you know, specialize in and focus your time on? Because everybody is volunteering at this level. And they get some things done, and they realize that they've got some internal inherent power. And that changes their posture, but eventually it changes the posture of the local government as well, who starts to notice them. And, you know, we do things occasionally to help that be noticed. One of my favorites is after a locally organized event to do some sort of ribbon cutting or event that looks like something that politicians would have liked to have attended, and then getting it on social media and ideally picked up by local media so that politicians feel like they missed a ribbon cutting. They hate that. And so then they start to get interested and say, hey, how come we weren't invited to your thing? And it just changes the conversation. One way we talk about it is, you know, instead of asking for a seat at the table, to make your own table and make it strong enough and interesting enough that the people at the table you were hoping to be at might come and sit down. And then when you ask for your seat at their table, you're in a much better position. You're not there on tokenism. You're not there because you scratched your way to it. You're there because they realize they needed you. So
help us understand when you say the people in the neighborhood are looking at what's there, and there's so much that it really is empowering for them to have that experience. What would much look like? You're in a neighborhood, and you're beginning to re-see it, to see something there that you didn't see before. What would you see? Can you give us some examples? What's there?
What's the new? Oh, wow. I generally have them create stations, and it might be in a church basement or a Boys and Girls Club or something like that, and say, around the six asset categories that you guys defined, in individuals, associations, institutions, physical space, exchange and economy, and then culture and stories. And we have people go around and write what they have in that neighborhood and then shift around until everybody in the room's had a chance. And then they look and they realize, it takes a little while for people to recognize, but they realize often that they have many institutional supports that they weren't paying attention to because they were focused on the ones that were ignoring them. Often they recognize an abundance of local businesses that might be interested in participating with them. They certainly recognize the informal groups and associations that are present. I've rarely been in a neighborhood where people didn't recognize there was lots of folks working with and trying to support young people, but not necessarily combining forces on that. And then individual gives and tell, the people who've worked together for years or lived near each other for years have no idea that that certain skills or abilities exist in an area, and that can open up ideas about what they want to do. It really varies by community, but it's always full. I never have enough flip chart paper. We're always writing on the sides and on the back.
Can I ask a question?
John? I'll give you an example.
Go ahead, Peter.
Oh, go ahead.
Ron, just to ground this, what you're saying is fascinating. Where's your point of contact? Give us examples of some points of contact where you begin this process. What are they doing? What are they up to? How do they find you?
Right.
Who pays
so
for you?
Most of my points of contact are local nonprofit institutions, sometimes local government, who've been to a training or heard about me or called the Asset-Based Community Development Institute and said, we're looking for somebody, we're interested in this process, we're interested in focusing on our assets, we're not sure how to go about it, and can somebody come help us do that? And it varies. I've had local Habitat for Humanity chapters. The National Habitat's done a lot to sort of push this orientation, become the point of contact. In Lodi, California, it was the Chamber of Commerce that had created a big Vision 2020 or Lodi 2020, and then realized that a particular neighborhood had really been left out of their process and wanted to create space for that, but knew they couldn't just go in and tell the neighborhood what they should do. A lot of times it is sort of broad thinking community development corporations. Either they've developed affordable housing or they've had some other technical community development skill that they brought to the community, but they want to, they know that there's more to what the community could do, and they want to learn that process.
It's almost like systems bring you in,
yeah,
and they're aware of the limitations of systems.
That's a good way to put it, yeah. And they wouldn't always say it that way when we get there. That's usually an early conversation we have.
Right. But at least they know that there's something in their efforts to engage, because everybody wants to engage.
Right.
But they know that there's an incident or something like that.
Well, and they've also learned that just having a meeting saying, hey, Wednesday night, everybody 7 o'clock, let's come together to make our community stronger is not, nobody believes you when you do that.
Right. You also said something that just woke me up. You said, when you have action without reflection, it leaves the leadership in the hands of professionals. But when you add reflection to it, it puts the leadership in the hands of citizens and neighbors. Could you say more about that? I just never thought about it that way.
When it's all about action, then a lot of times there's some professionals who are there sort of supporting it. They might just be the people doing the photocopying and arranging for the various things that have been organized to be there. And so I'll give you an example from a neighborhood that I'm working with in Rancho Cordova, California. Those people like this stuff done. So they organize an annual trunk or treat and an annual holiday parade at Christmas time. And it's pretty busy and a lot of stuff, but the city's supportive of it and helps, you know, make some arrangements and permits and helps connect with donors and stuff like that. But if it was just left to that, the next thing that would happen is that they would say, well, now here's what we want to do next. And they would turn to the city and say, what can you do for that thing? And mm-hmm. In Rancho Cordova, they've got a person on their staff who's really good about mirroring that back to them and saying, well, wait a minute, you know, what was the goal of the trunk or treat event? It wasn't just to have a party, what was the goal? How did it go? What did you learn from it? How does that affect what you want to do next? Those are sort of the four things we put in front of them. And it helps them think about, we did that because we wanted neighbors to know each other. We want people in our community to recognize each other. We're trying to get everybody out from just leaving work out of their garage and coming back from work in their garage and never coming outside and knowing their neighbors. And so then they'd start talking about the individual pieces of the trunk or treat that did that better or worse. And they change their next events based on that. I think that means that when that happens, then the leaders in the community are in charge of what's happening next versus just folks who are good at making lists of here's the things you need to do to get something done. I don't know if that makes sense.
Go ahead, Peter.
Well, just one more on this. And how do you insert reflection into the process?
Forcibly. you put it on the agenda.
What does it look like?
Well, with each group I work with, after they've done the assets and they figure out a couple projects they're going to do and how they're going to come together and do those ideally without needing to rely on outside institutions, then, you know, we set up what's your work plan, how's that going to happen, and I always say, where in here are you going to stop and think about how it's going, whether you need to change course, what you're learning. And usually they'll do it right after an event, like a cleanup or something. Sometimes they like to do it at a meeting later when they sort of celebrate their accomplishments, which is also important.
That's great. So you create space for, you put learning as one of the action steps.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Go ahead, John.
Yeah. I was just wondering, going back to how do you begin? It seems to me one of the problems that we keep hearing from people who are working with or in neighborhoods, that the assumption in the minds of a whole lot of people in neighborhoods is that the reason you get together is to figure out what it is you want the government to do, mm-hmm. or what it is you want some other external institution to do.
Schools.
Right. And it's very difficult to get a process going in which the first question is, what can we do? And I'm just wondering, in your experience, how do you move forward so that you don't get lost by the first question being, what will they do?
Well, there's a lot in that question. What?
Or, you know, a lot of meetings that are called community meetings are really bitch and moan sessions. I mean, it's sort of in the genes of how we as a neighborhood relate to governments, right? Or other institutions. Our purpose is to bitch and moan. and
right.
try to get somebody else to do something for us. And that's a powerful thing. And you got to do something, I think, to head that off and get the beginning to be, what do we got? I'm just
right.
wondering how you do that. How do you head it off?
With a lot of the communities I work with, I mean, I think Peter alluded to earlier, a lot of time there was some sort of incident or something that sort of generated some interest in people and connecting with each other. And then, yes, usually it turns right to, you know, how do we get institutions to behave the way we want them to? So a lot of times we just say it up front, you know, to acknowledge this, that all of you have probably been to meetings and here's what probably happened and that's not what we're doing here. In this process, we're going to figure out what we have to work with, what is inherent to our neighborhood as it is right now that we can build from and how we can use it to create the neighborhood we want it to be. And that will take some time to sort of come to some agreement around some key elements of the neighborhood as we want it to be, and then what we can do to get there. And then we'll figure out based on that where it's appropriate to ask institutions to be a little helpful. So a lot of times we use the three questions and we just tell people up front, these three questions: one, what can we do ourselves? What can we do with a little bit of outside assistance? And what do we need somebody from the outside to do? Helps people know we are going to get to that if it's really important. So it lets people kind of relax a little bit. What I find is a lot of the people who are hanging on to, you know, I'm here for that point in the process, let go of it because they get so excited by the first point in the process. So this group I talked about that does the trunk or treat and the holiday, they've done a lot of stuff. They initially came together because there had been some violence in their neighborhood and they were not happy with how the city handled it and they wanted to talk about that. We said that there's a place for that. It's called the city council meeting. You can go and tell them in these meetings we're going to work on creating a stronger neighborhood that makes it less likely that these things happen. And some folks walked away and said, nope, that's not what I want to be part of, and that was fine. I think it was actually a little helpful because it let everyone else know that the people in the room are the people who want to be here for this. And I'm not going to say they're not skeptical at the beginning. A lot of folks, you know, will say, well, I'm not sure how that's going to reduce crime, but well, I'm enjoying it because you're having me identify what I like and what I want to do, so I'm good with that. And then, you know, over some time, they figure out this is actually making a difference in a lot of the issues that they wanted the city to make a difference on. But I think it's just, there's no trickery to it. It's just being upfront and saying, this works better in most situations. And certainly, if you only do the outside thing, you're completely vulnerable to forces on the outside changing what you can get done. And I think, you know, after the last recession, a lot of people understood that. They saw local government collapse in a lot of areas. And so if you just want to set up programs, you're vulnerable to whoever funds those programs. If you set up stuff that you all do the way you want to do it, it will last as long as you want it to.
And you're also waiting for someone else's transformation.
Right, right. That's true.
That's risky business, you know.
Yeah.
Well, if you get the folks to the place where they've determined what they can do with what they have and then what they might do with a little outside assistance, that means that they're ready at that point to turn to, let's say, the government or the schools or the businesses or the social service agencies. And that's an adventure in and of itself. Making that kind of connection, I know, is something that you're often involved in. Can you tell us about approaches to reaching out?
And that can be, you mean reaching out to local government once the community is internally focused? That can be super powerful. Again, this city of Rancho Cordova is on my mind. They were working in, I told John the story of the neighborhood of West La Loma. It was a very dense area of a neighborhood full of affordable, but affordable for a reason, mostly slumlorded apartments. And all the crap that comes with that, you know, all the parasites who are attracted to that environment were there. And we met with the kids and found out what they wanted. And one of the most heartbreaking parts of some of these focus groups at the school with the fourth and fifth graders was when we asked them, you know, who's working to make your neighborhood better, we're trying to find out where the associations were. And they all named somebody, my uncle, my mom, my dad, my grandma. And we said, well, what are they doing? And to the kid, what they said that these people were doing to make the neighborhood better for them was keeping them inside. And mm-hmm. which was evident. If you walked through this very dense neighborhood, you saw very few people. Everybody was inside. So, you know, we did the straight up baby. We had the parents come to a meeting at the school, show them the vision the kids had created, which did involve candy streets and other things that were not attainable by associations or institutions. But the parents were a little bit inspired, and then we did a hands, head, heart exercise where parents identified their gifts and got busy. And over some time, they got a lot done, and a big transformation was then when they pulled off a big block party, and they engaged the city, who was initiating some of this work, to close off a street so they could have this block party and basically a big event for the kids. And there was one flyer sent home with all the kids at the local elementary school. But everything else was done. You know, we practiced going door to door and inviting your neighbors to a community picnic. And they pulled it off. There was like 500 people. It was a great event. In the process, they got to meet with local police officers and told them, here's where the problems are. Here's where the drug dealers exchange. Here's where when somebody is racing out of the neighborhood, the turn they take. And if you had some cameras there and put some speed bumps here, we think it would get better. And a few things happened. One, the police listened and they did all that. And two, the neighborhood, which was mostly made up of new immigrants, Spanish-speaking Mexican immigrants who were fairly frustrated with and afraid of local government, ended up seeing local government as a partner and came to the city council and said, here's what we learned. And kids said, now I play outside all the time because my friends are outside and my parents are outside. And it was very empowering for that group of people to approach local government once they came up with a vision they wanted, figured out what they can do, and then said, well, what we can't do or don't want to do ourselves is close off a street. So who do we ask about that? What we can't do or don't want to do is figure out, you know, all the permits around the food stuff. So who do we ask about that?
When you are working with a group and they get to the place where they're making contact, let's say the government in particular in this case, there have to be people in government who are receptive to the idea that it isn't their programs introduced to neighborhoods that are central. It is what they can do to support neighborhoods in their growth of power. How do you talk to people in government about that? What gets them to listen? That they're not the planner, pusher, designer, but that they really want to get some kind of change. They're going to have to see that the citizens become productive.
Yeah, well, I don't anymore. That was part of the shift for me. When I was a community organizer, I would do those. I would go have those coffees and have those conversations to make sure they were set up right. And that local government people were ready. Part of the action reflection process is now I will say to people, you know, I have a lot of experience in this and I know some things about it. So here's things local governments often do. Here's what you might be able to expect. Here's, you know, what the city of Riverside did or the city of Columbus, Ohio did. What do you want to do? And most of the time people will say, you know, well, we want to talk to our local government to do X, Y, and Z. And so then I'll, you know, engage in a process with them of figuring out who they have to talk to and how you do that. So a lot of times I might sit with people when they make a call to the planning director to say, hey, we'd like to meet with you. And we'll rehearse that. But I don't make those calls anymore. I think it's really critical that people in neighborhoods learn that they can make those calls and they should make those calls, and that that local government, while it might feel scary or a big institution, is actually supposed to just be an expression of the democratic process, and therefore should be there to work for them.
We have a chat question about technology. You know, what's your feeling about the use role with our infatuation with SurveyMonkeys and Facebooks and stuff?
Well, in general, I'm a big fan of technology. Like that question of where would you go back in time? I would not go back in time. I'm like, why would you go to somewhere before they had penicillin or anything like that? Like, I think in general it's good, but you know, each step is problematic, and we certainly have not intellectually caught up with our technological skills to connect in the digital age. But I don't think that's anything new. I think morally we took a while to catch up with, gunpowder and industrial revolution. Survey monkeys aren't, I think they're useful for like a group. Like I use them for when I'm doing a training of people who are coming to a training to find out kind of what they're expecting, what their experiences are, what they hope to get out of it in a one-time shot. But they're really not that valuable as a neighborhood tool. It's sort of like calling the meeting that all the people who are already interested in and know what they want to say come to. So I've really been, I've dissuaded people from SurveyMonkey a lot because it does tend to lead to the loudest voices. And I think Facebook and those have similar effects. What I tell people I'm working with, if they jump quickly to the, well, let's make a Facebook page for the neighborhood and stuff, is I just let them know that's fine. A lot of people will, especially in certain communities, will want to see a Facebook site or a website or something to know that you're real somehow, although that's eroding quickly. But that it can never, ever be a substitute for knocking on someone's door or calling somebody or meeting people, you know, at the grocery store, at the community center. That it's a nice reinforcer of relationships you've built in terms of local communities.
So we want to pause for a moment. Before we ask for questions, what do you call what you do today?
I don't.
Let me ask you. We're talking about, you know, there's a lot of desire to learn how to build community or something. Yeah. Is there a place that people can go to learn that? And would there be any use in us creating together some kind of certificate program or some kind of ongoing program to do this thing that we don't know how to name?
Right. I think so. I mean, the answer is yes to both. I do a lot of training with NeighborWorks America, and they have a track called Community Building and Organizing, or I think it got renamed Community Engagement because of DC politics around the word organizing. But it's about building community and helping people organize, and there's a lot of skills that can be picked up in those trainings. It's a broad swath, so depending on the trainer and the class, it may have this particular ground-up ABCD-type focus, and it may not. I think at the ABCD Institute, we're looking at trying to think of how we can provide more skills and understanding in this stuff. I think certificate programs are useful in that, not because like an academy would have to do or a university that has to sort of verify that you have a certain knowledge set, but just because people need them to get institutions to pay for them. So, calling something a training or a workshop and saying you get a certificate is that you actually went and showed up is important to helping the financial capital that's paying for social capital facilitation to get engaged. So I don't get too hung up on that.
So Maggie, you want to invite people to call in or chat more?
Sure. If you've dialed in and you'd like to participate in the conversation, press *8 on your telephone and you'll be put into a queue. There are a couple of things going on in the chat if you'd like to address those, but until we have someone calling in, which we don't right now.
Somehow my screen's cutting off the chat, so I can see who's on the call, but I can't see a chat box.
One question is, what language and exercise do you prefer to use to help prioritize the good ideas before the decision of which one will be pursued?
That's a great one. So there's always this process where there's 10 or 15 ideas up. What I do is I ask people to, it's almost like an open space. Well, by show of hands first, we'll say, you know, is there anyone who wants to lead project one? So this is how the whole trunk or treat happened. I had never heard of one. But somebody said they wanted to have, you know, some big event in the fall that brought me together. And so I just said, who wants to work with people to make that happen? Because I think that's how you prioritize. I think part of the problem is a lot of times in communities we prioritize based on what's the most important. And if, okay, yeah, the most important thing is we, you know, get rid of drug dealers. Well, no, a lot of folks don't sign up for that first, either because it looks scary or most likely if it's sort of an intractable issue, they don't know how to do that. So they don't want to sign up for something they don't know. But people will sign up for, we'll say, if you give permission to organize it based on what people want to work on, it virtually assures that then people will actually do stuff together. And that's part of the point. That's how their relationships
yes.
get built. That's how they have some wins. It's how they realize that their power actually is power and that they can get things done. And then later they'll come back and take on what look like the bigger or maybe more impactful issues. But I generally organize it around, you know, who wants to lead this? Who wants to lead that? And quickly what happens is there's a few projects that emerge as what people want to do.
Right.
And then we say, let's do it. And but each one has to have its own citizen leader or it's not going to work.
That's a great response. Rather, the importance of the issue, whereas the motivation and energy to initiate something. I have another question. Are you familiar with trauma-informed community engagement?
Yes. Not super familiar, but I've read about it and people have talked to me about it.
Could you give a headline, even at the risk of not understanding it?
Yeah.
Well, which you do all the time.
It's about working in, I mean, it's most of my career. It's working in communities that have had a lot of bad shit happen.
Yeah.
And so people are a little defeated and a little beaten down. Not just because, one, you know, government let them down once, but because, you know, violence has had, like, everything around them has been less than satisfactory, and they are pretty understandably skeptical.
You know, I to make it specific, what would you do in Las Vegas right now? I am acquainted with a group of community leaders, developers, people who kind of rebuild, and they're interested. How would you think about what we could do with a place like Vegas after the crisis they just had? With citizens, not with government.
Right, right. I mean, I think part of it is in those situations, it's first acknowledging, you know, this is terrible.
The grief.
This is bad. Yeah. Why do we hate this? Why? And let folks do that. And then I think the next piece is, you know, what do we have to work with and what can we do? I think skipping to what would solve this can be overwhelming for a local community. It's an important discussion, but I think local communities
Later.
Participate in big solutions in a better way if they've already engaged in what could we do, and what could we do based on what we have to work with. And I don't know what that is in Las Vegas. I don't know what that is in
right.
Texas. My guess is in Texas, there's probably, you know, it's very local. I mean, there's probably a lot of strong bonds and associations and groups of people who can do a lot for each other. I know in Aurora, I was caught off guard. I was working with a youth coalition, young people and sort of some service agencies that support them. And we were going through the assets. It was kind of a training on how to do asset mapping so they could go out and do it. And I asked, what are the culture and, you know, what are the stories of this community that brought you together? And to a person, whether they were 13 or there was an 84-year-old retired pastor in the group, they all said the theater shooting.
Mm-hmm.
So that story brought them together. And I said, well, how does that still live on for you? And they said, well, we started all these resilience centers that were just intended at the time to help people support each other in their grief, but have become places that people go to in all kinds of situations still around. But at the time, what they could do for each other was be supportive and create some spaces, you know, physical spaces where people knew that if I go here, I can talk to people about this.
Yeah.
And kids in that community remember their parents taking them into those places to just talk about it and be around other kids talking about it. And,
It also is almost like an identity crisis, like having to reconstruct who we are and the stories we tell about ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, we don't want to believe that that's who we are.
Right.
And in communities that have that trauma all the time, just shootings all the time, nobody wants to believe that's who they are, and they generally don't, especially, I mean, communities that have this happen all the time are less surprised and often prepared to be more resilient because they've had to figure this out.
Cool. So let me ask Maggie, any calls waiting?
No calls waiting, Peter.
Okay, good.
You know, there is somebody, I see somebody in the chat here, Elliot, I don't know if you're still there and would be willing to jump on, but Elliot Hurwitz, who's on this, has been through a couple sets of the Northern California fires. His own community was burned down several years ago in Lake County. And then I know he's still in the area where the fires just hit again. And I've been impressed with what they've done to respond to that sort of trauma. I don't know if Elliot's there or able to unmute himself.
I unmuted Elliot.
Oh. Hi, is this, are we on here?
You're on, Elliot.
Okay, hi, yeah, I'm here with Magdalena. Yeah, we saw your this call come up and definitely wanted to check in with you, Ron. We've been just to fill people in. Folks may remember that even prior to these most recent wildfires out here in Northern California, 2 years ago there was a similar event that happened,
a series
of fires that caught us up in its wake and.
At that time, it was the third largest wildfire in California history, and now we've been out outmooted.
So it really did become for us a major kind of community organizing kind of pivot. And on the basis of that, one of the things that we decided personally is because of the ties that we had in the area, we decided that
Well, actually, the way it started was we are part of a neighborhood, and we started all looking out for each other. So I just wanted to do a plug-in for your article, Ron, about who are actually the first responders. It's not the sheriffs or the firemen. It's going to be people that you know. And from there, partly because of my disaster background, and then, of course, both Elliot and I have this kind of background in government and nonprofit work, we started looking for the agencies that would be coming around. And what was interesting was that we were keeping our antennae open specifically for nonprofits that were local. And we ended up getting, because of our presence and looking around and asking questions and introducing ourselves, we were able to get in touch with the local community radio person who they had become, KPMZ had become the information resource, not the county, but the community radio station had. And from there, we started to find Friends of Cobb Mountain, Friends of Boggs Mountain, and suddenly we were meeting all kinds of people who have been embedded in the community for so long, and we came together and created our own municipal advisory council, because it turns out that California can do that.
By simple resolution, apparently, the Board of Supervisors can just kind of take a crayon, draw a shape, and say, you're hereby empowered as a community council. So that was the, since that time, basically, it took us about 10 months to kind of get that off the ground. So that's been really the center, has become a new center of kind of community focus for us, both in terms of continuing the recovery process, which in disasters of this size take, a decade, really.
Now we can invite the police chief and the water district people and the firefighters. They come to our meetings, and they know that we've been around for a year.
One of the things I enjoyed watching about that process was just how everybody, it was a disaster. It was a trauma for the community. People lost their homes, but people quickly just came together and started talking to each other and associating, and then now have turned that into a bit of a power structure where they can guide how local government works in their area. So I just wanted to call them out as I think, but go ahead, Peter.
I'm just saying, Elliot, do you have two voices or is there somebody with you?
There's two of us here.
tell us who you are.
My name is Magdalena Valderrama Hurwitz.
And I'm Elliot.
Magdalena. I just wanted to get your name on record.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Yeah. Go ahead, Ron.
Ron, we're getting toward the end of our time. And one thing that I think it would be very valuable if you could share your thoughts on is a lot of what we hear about is ways of calling forward people who haven't come forward before and who have sort of leadership potential. But there's something beyond that that I have a feeling you've had experience with that would be of value, and that is, supposing you said, what I want to do mainly by my contribution in this neighborhood is to maximize the number of people who are participating. But that's my goal. What they do is less important to me than that we democratize, we get as many people as possible. Give us some techniques, rules, ideas. What do you do to maximize the participation from a local group?
Or would you take that as a goal?
Well, we take it as a goal. I mean, when I meet with groups, I'm pretty clear that the experience of many communities is that the more people who are engaged at any level, the healthier and stronger the community will get, and all the social capital stuff. And therefore, none of their goals are going to be as well done as they could be if they haven't maximized participation in the neighborhood and connected neighbors to each other. We know this at so many levels that the best thing you can do to make your neighborhood safer is make sure all your neighbors and they know each other. If I'm in a longer engagement with a group, I will let them know, you have to do one-to-one learning conversations or we won't get anywhere. We have to do some sort of listening campaign so that you can connect with and know not just who your neighbors are, but what they care about and what they want to do if they had an opportunity to do something. So John knows I'm a big, big fan of learning conversation as a sort of fundamental unit of social change, because I don't think we have any authentic change unless people's care, their heart is in it. And we only know that by stopping to listen to them and not just counting which meetings they came to. So I push my groups a lot to, and we get nitty gritty with it. We say, how many people are going to do these? Five or six? Okay, how many can you do a week? And we figure out how many weeks will it take doing a couple of these a week till we've listened to some critical mass at the neighborhood, 50, 100 people. And that always changes things. But it does allow leaders or engaged citizens to then lead by connecting each. They can say, oh, I just talked to Dolores on the other block. She does that too. Did you know that? And helping people connect with each other around what they already care about before trying to convince them to care about some idea we have.
And so I knock on the door. I'm going to have a listening session. Can you give us a little description of
how you
proceed to do that?
Door knocking. Usually there's a core group of five or six people, and I say, who do you know here that you could go have a listening conversation? And we start with people you already know. There's no valor in being super brave about this.
Start with
the people you know. And then ask them, who else do you know here that I should talk to?
Absolutely.
And then, you will pretty quickly get to some people you didn't already know or know well, or just knew that she's the woman who walks her dog at 4:30 every day. And so there are places for door knocking campaigns, but I think door knocking campaigns are usually the result of organizations that don't know the community well and haven't been invited there, having to kind of get themselves invited. Whereas I think when you're working with resident leaders, it's a matter of saying, who can you talk to? Okay, go talk to them and ask each of them for three names and go talk to them.
That's great.
So we're
about at the end, I think. John, any final questions or Ron, anything you'd like to say about this conversation or what you see?
I really appreciate that Ron would share what he's done because he's had such wonderful experiences and has, in a way, combine the capacity of local people to mobilize their resources where they are with what they have, but also to have the skill and ability to reach outside when they need to and do it effectively. So blend it inside and outside, I think, in a very effective way.
Thanks.
Ron,
final? For final thought, I'm going to share, I was orienting a new staff person at the Rural Community Assistance Corporation, and so we're going to work with communities based on a lot of principles. Here's Saul Alinsky's Rule for Radical, and here's McKnight and Kretzmann's Building Communities from the Inside Out. In the first month here, read those, then we'll talk about it. And she came back and said, this Rules for Radical thing is fine for the, if you give a man a fish, he eats for a day. You teach him how to fish, he eats forever. But what if he sucks at fishing? And she liked building communities from the inside out because she said that says we just need to find out what they're good at. Maybe somebody's good at tying nets. Maybe somebody's good at reading the weather. Maybe somebody's good at making food to support the fishermen. That we don't have to teach everyone to fish. We have to find what they're good at, and then we can have a good fishing village. And that rocked my world. But I think pretty much sums up how we blend these approaches.
Yeah, good.
That's good. I also think that there's a lot of conversation about churches and the faith community.
Oh, yeah.
And the church into community and out of the building. And it seems to me like that's what you're doing. You're doing liberation theology in a very grounded and practical way. The way you talk about it is so clear. I just really appreciate that and appreciate you coming on this one. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for having these conversations. I enjoy listening to them.
Cool. All right, Maggie.
Okay, Peter. Well, Ron, thank you. This conversation really does reinforce that the change we want starts with us. We can't wait for somebody else. So thank you for taking the time to be with us today, and thank you to our listeners and to Elliot and Magdalena for participating. If you'd like to learn more about Ron's work, you can visit www.pacificcommunitysolutions.com. And until our next conversation, please visit our website, www.abundantcommunity.com. Stay in touch with us on the web and on Facebook, because that does work. And this brings our program to a close today, and thank you all for joining us.